Started. My name is Ed Howard. I'm with the Alliance for Health Reform. And on behalf of Senator Jay Rockefeller, Senator Susan Collins, who are members of our informal leadership and our board of directors, I want to welcome all of you to this briefing for folks in the media on how to cover the health reform story between now and 2014, when the big stuff starts exploding. Our partners in sponsoring this briefing are the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation and the Association of Healthcare Journalists. RWJ is, most of you know, the country's largest health and healthcare philanthropy, one of the most active as well. I want to recognize, if I can find him, Adam Coyne, who's the Director of Public Affairs and Social Media at the foundation. They have a variety of tools that reporters can use, and everybody else who's interested in understanding the health reform issues can use. Representing the association, we have Len Brazies, who's the executive director of the association. And Len, I have a hunch that there are a lot of people both in the room and listening on the conference call who are not familiar with the good work that your organization does, and maybe you could tell them about it in a very brief form.
All right, thanks, Ed. As Ed said, I am with the Association of Healthcare Journalists, which is a 12-year-old organization made up of about 1,000 journalists across the country. And we're pleased to be partnering with the Alliance and the Foundation on this event, mostly because of the importance of the topic and the enormity. It's the very reason that our organization was founded, was reporters coming together, reporters and editors, to share resources, to network, to help each other on story ideas and such, and to educate each other, which this event exemplifies. So if you aren't already a member, we hope you'll check out healthjournalism.org and see what we have to offer. Thanks.
Great. Thanks very much, Len. And he'll be available for consultation in the corner there as we go along. By the way, contact information electronically for both of these gentlemen is at the bottom of the agenda in the materials that you have in front of you. You'll also find in your kits a lot of background material, as well as a list of even more background material that we didn't kill trees to print, but posted online at www.allhealth.org. I wanted to draw some particular attention to the source book for journalists. Bill, do you have a copy of that anywhere around? It's online, and it's part of our collaboration with the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation. It's, a very useful tool setting out sort of what you need to know to get started in a whole variety of topics related to reform. We've recently updated it with the material needed to make it current following the enactment of the legislation. And there's somewhere a flyer that gives you information about that update. There's a Spanish version that we're in the process of updating that is pretty far along as well, also available on that allhealth.org website. I mentioned Bill Irwin. If you need more information about the source book or anything else that will help you chase a story or think through a story, Bill Irwin is the go-to guy. He's standing over there with the handheld mic. He's a seasoned reporter himself. He's our communications director at the Alliance for Health Reform. Bill, you're also kind of the person who makes sure that our cooperation with the foundation in furtherance of journalists' ease of pursuing stories gets done well. I wonder if you could just make sure that people know who you are.
Well, thanks. It's a great pleasure to be teaming up with the Robert Wood Johnson and the healthcare journalists today. This is the first time this particular trio has done a briefing here at the Press Club. Robert Wood Johnson has a long history of helping us help journalists. The foundation has supported five editions of the Covering Health Issues book And actually, the what's online right now is really a sixth edition since we've updated every single chapter. And we've been involved with the healthcare journalists since, from the very beginning, back in Indianapolis all those years ago, where Ed and I both were, had the pleasure of attending your very first conference. So it's wonderful to be here, and thanks for everybody for coming, and for those on the phone for phoning in.
Great. Now, some of you are clearly recognizing, and that's why you're here, that the new health reform law is a huge step. Many people say it's a huge step forward. certainly not a complete harmony in the chorus on that question, but you're probably looking for ways to make your readers and viewers and listeners grasp the magnitude of what's going on now, what kind of preparations are being made for the huge changes in store in the future, and that's what today's session is all about. And I have to tell you that as somebody who started out in the newsroom of a small daily in Beaver Falls, Pennsylvania, in the 1960s, I am honored to be moderating this discussion. We've got a terrific panel of nationally respected health journalists to give us their best insights into this challenge. And I'm going to introduce them very quickly, only by name and title, not as fully as they deserve, of course, and there's background information in your packets, and ask each to say just a sentence or two to identify themselves, in part to let our colleagues on the conference call around the country associate a voice with a name. We have four great reporters for you. And let's start with Julie Rovner, who's a correspondent with National Public Radio. Julie?
Hi.
Excellent.
Must be radio.
Next to Julie is Phil Galewitz, who's with Kaiser Health News and happens to also be a member of the board of the Association of Healthcare Journalists.
Thank you for having me.
You guys are great. Going to my left, we have Joanne Kennan, who runs the New Health Dialogue blog at the New America Foundation and has no microphone in front of her.
Hi, glad you have me here to speak up for the bloggers.
And finally, Noam Levy of the LA Times.
Happy to be here. Thank you.
Okay. We're going to hear from them briefly, not that briefly, but briefly at this point, with an initial piece of advice for you to chew on, and then we'll open it up to questions both from those of you around the table and those of you who are listening on the conference call. In the latter case, you'll be doing it by email, by sending an email to info@allhealth.org. So let's get started, we'll start in the same order that we heard those eloquent speeches just a moment ago with Julie Roth.
Thank you. I have a little more to say than hi. I am actually a proud charter member of the AHCJ, mostly because one of its founding board members, Joanne Silberner, sat next to me at NPR, and I didn't have a lot of choice. But I am actually pleased to maintain my membership in AHCJ. I thought I'd talk a little bit about how it is I do what I do with the health legislation, which I've been covering for this is now my 25th year. And here, for those of you who are interested, I brought my own book to FLAC. If you want to know more about not so much the bill, but about the background of health policy, I've written an encyclopedia available from CQ Press. You can look at it afterwards. As I mentioned, I've been doing this for quite a while, and how I go about it has changed. I was thinking about this yesterday. In 1990, the best way to cover health policy was you went back to your desk and you waited for the phone to ring. By 1995, we had emails, and then you went back to your desk and you waited for emails to come in. By 2005, you could be walking around and you would check your BlackBerry for email. And now we have 2010, and you get to check your little iPhone. And we have Twitter, so you know things happen a little bit faster. But one thing that has not changed is that covering this beat involves an enormous amount of reading. It used to be just websites. Now we have websites, and thanks to people like Joanne, blogs. So I think there's more reading. I have to get up earlier in the morning, I think, to stay ahead on this beat. I don't think any of this comes as a great revelation to anybody who's ever thumbed through the Alliance's wonderful Covering Health Issues handbook or perused AHCJ's website. But here are some of the places that I spend a lot of time online when I'm not wandering the halls of Congress, although sometimes I do both simultaneously. This is the problem with having an iPhone. Some of my favorite websites, as I'm sure many of you share, the Kaiser Family Foundation. I think it's sort of the first among equals, just the amount and depth of information and the ease of reading that it has is really unparalleled. The Commonwealth Fund and the RWJ website also have some really wonderful background information. A little bit less, I think, common, but also some great gems. The Urban Institute Health Policy Center, some of that can be a little bit harder to get through. It's a little bit wonkier, but really good stuff. Center on Budget and Policy Priorities has some wonderful background papers. For those on the other side of the political spectrum, the American Enterprise Institute, the Heritage Foundation, and Cato have some really good stuff. And then there are the blogs, and this obviously there, you know, you could spend days and days doing nothing but reading blogs. One of my favorites, though, is called THCB, the healthcare blog. Again, it's a little bit wonky, but it's a source of not just really interesting stuff, but stuff that I tend to get ahead of the curve. It's really some of the big thinkers in health policy, and a lot of different big thinkers in health policy. Then sort of a one-man blog that I'm fond of is Bob Leshefsky, who's a former insurance consultant. I guess he's still an insurance consultant, but I think you hear him. You see him quoted a lot, you hear him quoted a lot, and there's a reason he's a really smart guy. The New America Foundation, and not just because Joanne is a friend of mine, but because there's good stuff there. The blog that Health Affairs runs, again, they bring together a lot of good, smart people who do good, smart stuff. Think Progress, that's the Center on American Progress, just because it's fun to read. and they also have a lot of good stuff. And Ezra Klein, again, friend of mine, smart guy, and I like to read his stuff. Oops, I have another page here. Here's a little advice about what I'm doing these days, and this is how I'm going about, you know, taking this 2,700-page behemoth and trying to break it down a little bit. And I think that this can apply to not just national reporters but local reporters. I'm actually trying to take the bill apart piece by piece and do individual stories. There's still an enormous amount of misinformation, some of it intentional, some of it unintentional, about what's in this new law. I've recently done stories on the CLASS Act. That's the long-term care piece, story you have in your packet about young people being able to stay on their parents' plans. I mean, these are things that I think a lot of reporters have already done. There's lots more pieces you can do. You can get a summary of the bill. The Kaiser website has a particularly good one. Frankly, you can throw a dart at it and pick any portion and go after it. But here's a couple of examples that you could really localize. One of them is, how would the new law affect small businesses? There actually is no employer mandate, particularly obviously not for small businesses. There's a tax credit already in effect this year for small businesses that many don't even know about. What would be the real impact of this law on Medicare and on seniors? Seniors are very confused, and that's, we obviously have seen this argument now going on in Washington. Republicans say that the Democrats are, you know, issuing propaganda. Seniors don't know what to believe. Yes, some seniors may lose extra benefits from cutbacks to Medicare Advantage plans, but many will see new benefits for preventive care. Obviously, that this is a story that can be done again and again and again and can perform a real public service. There's lots of smaller, less covered stories in the bill that you could do locally. There's a tanning tax. There's tanning salons, I think, in every town. There are requirements that will come into effect next year to post calorie counts on menus at chain restaurants. I mean, you could find out if other restaurants will be doing that that aren't required to, just to keep up, you know, with the for competitive services. So there's an awful lot to keep everybody busy, and my advice is go for it.
All right. Very good. And I guess I would be remiss if I didn't point out that today was the day when the first donut hole prescription drug checks were supposed to be mailed out. So if you haven't followed that story, at the local level, you probably can get a 2 days from now, great story of somebody ripping open that check and going to Walmart. Let's turn now to Phil Gabelitz. Phil?
Hi there. Well, I've been on the beat not as long as Julie, only 20 years instead of 25 years. So when I was asked today to talk about, well, how can we keep the health reform stories fresh, keep our editors interested, I guess I think about, well, I've been on the beat for 20 years, and it's mainly all the same issues. We were writing about Medicare, Medicaid, the uninsured, businesses can't afford health care. There's nothing new here. We've been writing this for decades. So the challenge that we face in keeping this fresh is the same challenge we've always had. And before going on, I guess I wanted to ask the audience, who here has been on the beat for less than 2 years? Would you raise your hand? Hi. Okay. Who here has been on the beat for less than 5 years? Okay. So this is a pretty seasoned, experienced crew we have here. So we have our work ahead of us. So basically, the things that I'm trying to do in looking for stories, kind of like Julie was saying, is sort of looking for the nuggets. There's so many pieces of the bill that you could write whole stories and get really into depth. So what I think we as reporters need to do, I think we've done a good job already, but is to continue to following the money is a big thing. There's so many new dollars in here, in new programs that haven't got a lot of attention. I mean, some of the main debates of the bill I think have been covered, but now we need to sort of see where the money's at. Programs like National Health Service Corps getting millions and millions of dollars. Money for nursing home pilot programs are a couple examples. But there's dozens and dozens of examples as you look through the bill of programs that are going to be getting a lot of money over the next 5, 6, 7 years. And my view is even if we realize the effect of that money, we won't know for a long time, it gives us a good entry view to look and see, well, how are those programs running now? The other thing I think we really need to do is sort of related to the money, is how are groups, both nonprofit and for-profit, hospitals, health insurers, doctors, clinical laboratories, how are they all sort of strategizing now to take most advantage? Everybody's looking to make money off of healthcare reform. It's like healthcare, people want to make money off of it. I don't see healthcare reform any different. So I think a key thing that journalists need to do is really see how many different aspects every kind of health business, every health-related business, what are they doing to sort of change how they're operating? How are teaching hospitals changing to react to new money, new programs in the bill to try to shift the workforce toward more primary care is one example. How are clinical laboratories trying to change what they're doing because people are going to be able to get health care coverage without any copayments? So, for example, people expect there'll be a much higher demand for a lot more tests, a lot more in the laboratory, a lot more blood tests, because they won't have to pay either on Medicare or on private. They won't be paying that copayment. The other thing I think we sort of need to do is keep a really good eye on the states. I mean, as we look at the national government, what's going on there, I think a lot of things we'll see at the state level. We'll see some states move ahead. Obviously, we've all written a lot about Massachusetts, but I think it's worth looking at some of the reforms going on in other states. Obviously, Utah is another state where they've tried exchanges, but they've got a lot less publicity than Massachusetts. They've tried to do things a little differently. Other states have passed health reform laws to expand coverage ahead of the federal government. Colorado, Oregon are a couple other examples. So what I try to do is sort of look at the states. There's a lot of states where I think there's a lot of interesting things going on, so I would keep doing that. The other thing, in addition to following the money, is sort of following the calendar. You know, there's a lot of things being implemented right now or the next few months, as we know, the dependent coverage, the small business tax credits, the high-risk pools. I think we've done a pretty good job, as everybody, following the regulation writing, but there's also going to be a lot of things happening in 2011, with the CLASS Act, and that's going to start, I guess, the money will be start to collect in 2011. The medical loss ratios for the health plans will have to deal with that. Again, the cost sharing being eliminated on some things with Medicare, new incentives for Medicare recipients to live healthier. And I think it's important for us to get – there's a lot of things going on now about how the government and how industries are preparing for these changes that are going to be occurring beginning of next year. And as always, I think we have a lot of stories that I think we need – that we've always followed that we got to even follow more intensely. Come this fall, come September, October, we're going to hear about all the changes with Medicare Advantage. And a lot of these changes really aren't necessarily about what was in the law but was in the funding cuts for next year. So as a reporter who's been covered healthcare on a regional and national level, Medicare Advantage is always a big story every fall because seniors are looking forward to see what the changes will be. I think that'll be even doubly important because a lot of people will be following it even more closely. The other thing will be the push as, in 2014 with millions of people being added to Medicaid and millions more being given money to help buy insurance more cheaply on exchanges. The question is, how will these people really join? Will these people really sign up for coverage? I think it's a big question. I think there's a big story out there that can be done in every local community, every state, and even at the national level for, do the people who don't have insurance today, will they really go buy it? And just because there'll be a mandate on many people, not everybody, what will be the real push and how effective will it be to get everybody in there? And there's a lot of things going on at both national level and the state level to make that happen, and I think that's definitely one of the stories worth following. And I think it's just important to look for the conflicts, look who's trying to make a lot of money out there in business, follow that. As Len Braziz was saying, HCJ has a lot of good resources. I've been on the board of HCJ for the last 4 years, and I'm the membership chair. And I joined AJ. I was at the first meeting back in Chicago 10 years ago, and I joined it largely to network, meet other reporters. I'm a firm believer that, you know, yes, we compete every day, but I think we're also in a business where we can share a lot and we can share stories. And I have no problems calling up reporters and asking them how they did a story, and hopefully nobody would ever have a problem asking me for advice on finding a source or having a story of how did I did something. I think journalists really have a lot to gain from each other, and that's really what the whole YHCJ was formed in the first place. But if you go online, another blog that we have a Covering Health blog that we started last year that sort of gives an overview of shows great healthcare journalism out there, and I think it's something that you should put on your bookmark. And we also offer tip sheets covering hospitals, nursing homes, CDC, and reporting guides, and just a lot of resources if you go to healthjournalism.org. If you've never been there, I think it's really eye-opening. So I look forward to taking your questions, and thank you very much.
Great. Thanks, Phil. And I believe there are one or two pieces from the association in the packets, along with a pretty good selection of some of the timetables that have been put together that will help you follow the calendar, as you were saying. Let's move now to Noam Levy from the LA Times. Noam?
Thank you, Ed, and thanks so much for having me. I am a real baby on this beat compared to my esteemed colleagues at the other end of the table, but spent a lot of time in the hallways of Congress over the last 2 years watching this sausage get made. And I wanted to share with you just a caution and then a couple pieces of advice, I guess, for broader story themes to think about. The first caution is that I think there is a tendency now with the implementation, with this being sort of a little bit of this gray area where nobody really knows exactly what's going to happen, for an enormous amount of speculation to sort of be filling this void. And I guess what I would warn is that nobody really does know, despite what they may claim, what's going to happen. But the critics, I think, of the bill are very aggressively sowing stories of doom and gloom, and by the same token, the administration and some of the champions on the Democratic side of the aisle are also putting forward probably slightly inflated claims about what the bill will do, notwithstanding the $250 checks that a few million seniors will be getting starting now. But that being said, there obviously are big challenges and there are big opportunities in the bill, and I wanted to touch on just a couple of them, really focusing, I think, on what is happening at the state level. I think in many ways that is where the most interesting part of the story is right now, not only because states will be running the exchanges and expanding Medicare in 2014, but in 2014, but because they, notwithstanding the criticism from Republicans about a federal government takeover, there is an enormous amount that is left to the states to do. And I think, I realize this is somewhat odd for a Washington-based reporter to say this, but I think if you can, leave here and go and see what's happening out there, and if you can't, work with reporters back at the newspaper where you work, to look for what's going on there. Two storylines that I would point you to particularly, which I think are very interesting and will be decisive in the coming years between now and 2014 and beyond. One, insurance regulation. This is obviously what was happening in the insurance market was probably the biggest debate of the healthcare bill. What is happening with premiums, I think, now will be probably the biggest debate between now and 2014. It is certainly the thing that the administration is most worried about. One thing that I think people don't necessarily realize is that while there are a lot of new regulations for insurance companies, particularly after 2014, there isn't that much in the bill that actually gives regulators the ability to really review and even change what insurance companies can charge. And that remains a function that is almost completely at the discretion of states. So what does that mean for the purposes of writing stories? There is an amazing variety in what states are doing out there. Some states are extremely aggressive in regulating how much their insurance companies are charging on the individual and the small group markets. Oregon, Massachusetts, Maine, some of these states, New York just passed a law actually yesterday to strengthen their ability to review. I would suggest that going and looking what's going on at the state level and the dynamics that are playing out in legislatures and in governor's offices and what is happening with state insurance regulators would be very, very interesting and pretty provocative. The other thing that I would talk direct you to a little bit, and Phil mentioned this, is the degree to which the states are prepared to actually take advantage of a lot of the opportunities that are coming forward. As Phil mentioned, there are some states, Massachusetts being the biggest, but also Colorado, Minnesota, Utah, that have taken steps already to try to reform their health insurance markets, healthcare more broadly. Many have not. I was just down in Mississippi doing a story down there where that state doesn't like Medicaid, hasn't liked Medicaid, and was one of the last states to implement Medicaid when Medicaid was created in 1965. And there are interesting ways in which states have acted over the past few years, over the past decades, in terms of taking advantage of public programs, signing people up. How aggressive are they? How much have they expanded SCHIP? And then looking forward, what is the capacity in these states to actually create the infrastructures that will be necessary to get ready in 2014? We've seen a little bit of the debate about high-risk pools. I think that's a start. I think there's also a question about who's going to actually run their own exchange in 2014. Are there the people who work there who do that? So those are a couple things. Really quickly, some suggestions just in addition to the wonderful resources that have been mentioned so far. One would be I would shamelessly use and abuse trade groups here in Washington and lobbyists. They are have an incredible agenda, obviously, but they're also in touch with their members back around the country who have stories to tell. And anxieties to share. Find consultants and analysts are always a good source. People who are going out there. I was talking to a hospital analyst the other day who's traveling around the country meeting with anxious hospitals as they try to figure out what this new world is going to look like. And then one other source on the web, which I think is good, stateline.org has a really good compilation of newspaper articles out there, and as the only representative of that medium up here, I want to plug it and say that they're still doing a good job of reporting what's happening in states. So that's it. Thank you.
Let me do a brief commercial for something that that Bill has put in a lot of time in, Bill Irwin, and that is that the Alliance has put together a list of experts, self-selected. Well, we select them, and then they decide whether or not they'll take the time and the trouble to fill out the form that we ask them to, so that online 24/7 you could see who would be an expert in an area like Medicare Advantage, who lives west of the Mississippi, has B-roll if you're a television reporter, and can do an interview in Spanish. We may not have too many people who fit into that category. Point is, though, if you can take advantage of that service, the Find an Expert service, there are a lot of folks who can get you started in a particular issue and in a particular way. So, Joanne, I've made you aware. Joanne Subtoo, I'm sorry. Joanne Kennan.
Hi. I covered healthcare on the Hill with Julie and other people for many years. There were times when I think I spent more hours in the hallway with Julie during the week than I saw my children. And obviously, the year I, one year when I was on maternity leave, I came back and nothing had changed. Anyone who took this year off is going to find that everything changed. And yet, I think some reporters have a problem of editors wanting one of two things. Either, oh, that's so last year, you know, healthcare's over, or they only want to cover it as a political story. You know, who's up, who's down, what's the impact in November and the, all the Novembers to come. So I wrote the first chapter of the source book. It's in your packet. It's online, so you know my favorite resources and websites. Try covering healthcare in the early 90s when there wasn't the internet, where we had to go to these briefings and go home and file everything and then remember where we put it. So you can see my favorite resources there. But I thought what might be useful is to sort of describe three stories I've done, and you're welcome to steal them if they apply to you, because there are ways of keeping it fresh and telling it differently. One was a story I did right before I left Reuters, and I talked to colleges about health policy is this huge field. It didn't exist. There was no such thing as an undergraduate health policy major. It's now enormous. And you could sort of take that in your community. Why are students going into this? What is their career path? What are they perceiving? What are their professors perceiving? Why are universities investing in these programs? I got a really good national story out of it. It could be revisited locally, and it'll be different in each community and the way the programs shape up. But it was sort of, it was a very fun story. It let me be very narrative, and I also squeezed a lot of policy in there. The second one I want to mention is, I don't have it online, so we couldn't include it, but if you're in the supermarket this weekend, in the June Washingtonian, I profiled a family that had three generations of doctors. The grandfather's no longer alive, and it took me a year and a half to find them, so that was the hard part, and writing it was really a lot of fun, because Grandpa was a GP who practiced in the back of his house, you know, and people paid him in tomatoes, and they mowed his lawn.
Chickens?
There were some chickens there, too, right? There actually were a couple of chickens, but the son is the head of vascular surgery at Washington Hospital Center here in D.C., and of the three grandchildren, two are doctors, and one is the woman of, you know, who wants to combine career and children is, of course, an anesthesiologist. Really interesting, bright person. She's doing only regional nerve blocks for orthopedic surgery for people whose hearts can't withstand general anesthetic. Basically, that's how specialized she is. And the grandson is an endovascular surgeon doing, you know, minimally invasive aortic repairs at the Mayo Clinic, doing things I can't even pronounce. And that let me, you know, really tell the story of specialization to subspecialization, fragmentation, the problems in coordinating care. It let me really tell, and also bringing it back to Mayo and integrated care. And there's a great-grandson who follows his dad around with the black bag. So it was a tremendously fun story to do, and it really told people a lot about what does our medical system look like, what does our healthcare system look like, and how, you know, what are the changes these people may face in the future. And the third story I want to talk about in a little more detail until Ed picks up his little sign is a story I did for a fairly small magazine, actually, and it got an enormous amount of feedback. I got a lot of feedback. It got a lot of attention, even though the platform was sort of small. And it also was useful for those of you who were writing in different medium. It was a story where I was able to go back and forth between my blog and the magazine piece, and they fed off each other over a period of months in sort of an interesting way. And it was the story I did. It's in the packet on the Disclose and Apologize Alternative to Medical Malpractice. And like everybody else in the Hill, I had covered the annual malpractice fight between the Democrats and the... And it's one of those things that can make you very cynical, because there was there's all sorts of deals to be had. Nobody really wanted a deal. Everybody just wanted to get up and give their set pieces about it, about, you know, two very rigid approaches that weren't going to go anywhere. You know, you could write your story before it started. I mean, none of us actually did that, but, you know, we could have. Some of us might have, right? A year or two later, in 2008, I guess it was originally, I was with Tom Daschle, and I heard him start talking a little different. You know, he wasn't in office anymore, and he said something different about malpractice, and my ears perked up. And I began paying attention and listening to people as I heard Democrats beginning to speak, not office holders, but people Daschle, Zeke Emanuel, other people, I began paying attention to what they were saying and writing, and I was hearing something different. And I began blogging on that because it opened the door to some new ways of looking at this. And then I wrote a piece for One Magazine about alternative dispute resolution and why it wasn't just to fight over malpractice caps, why there are issues. I've got it into, you know, there are really issues of why the quality, people who are involved in the quality movement really care about this, people involved, who see it, who want to do new forms of delivery systems, see the doctors' perceptions, and the doctors' perceptions and the economists' perceptions are not the same, why this is an obstacle to change, and how do you pare away the various incentives, how much of it is defensive medicine, how much is it you could just make more money doing all that stuff, whether you're even conscious of those incentives. So I began looking at this both on the blog and in the first magazine piece, you know, from a bunch of new voices and new perspectives. And I got interested in it partly because it was also the nexus of so many things that are wrong with healthcare. I mean, I like writing about hospital readmissions for the same reasons. You know, if you can fix that problem, you could fix an awful lot of things. And then, you know, the model I kept hearing about was the disclose and apologize model. And we've all read stories about the University of Michigan. You know, there's been a lot written there. And Obama likes the disclose and apologize model. And there's federal grant money coming out very, very soon, which is another keep an eye on the ARC website, because those grants are going to be made pretty quickly. And in 25 communities, you'll have a local story about it. Up to 25 communities. I don't know how they do the grants. And then I went to talk to the people at Michigan and Illinois, which is the other model. And the story we'd been hearing all the time is, you know, if you say you're sorry, the family won't sue. Well, I thought, well, you know, that's sort of easy. Why aren't all hospitals doing this? And it turned out to be really complicated. It's hard to replicate. And I came away with sort of two lessons. One is there are all sorts of technical reasons where it's hard to replicate, having to do with whether you're self-insured and how many malpractice insurers are in the room. And, you know, a university system is different than a community hospital. And the other reason was it really isn't about apologizing. It's about fixing things. If you say, I'm sorry, that doesn't make the family go away happy. If you say, I'm sorry, and I'm accountable, and this is what I'm going to do, lets the families. And then there's actually an arbitration process, and it's more complicated. So I did that piece, and then, of course, I was able to go back and blog it, and then I got comments on the piece, and I blogged about that. So it all interconnected, and it really took me away from a very stale political debate about malpractice to a much more complex debate about healthcare quality and new delivery systems and financial incentives and accountability. So I actually had fun with that story, too.
Great. Thank you, Joanne. Kenneth. You've all been very patient, but I've noticed a lot of scribbling of story ideas and approaches, so maybe you haven't been bored while you listen to these presentations. I certainly have been taking a lot of notes. By the way, if you have questions about any of the sources that have been cited and you can't track them down, let us know, because we can get you the websites without any trouble, and maybe some people to talk to on those. The floor is now open. If you will be kind enough to raise your hand and let somebody come to you with a microphone so that everybody can hear the question, not just everyone in the room, but those of you on the conference call, would appreciate it. And if you'd identify yourself, would appreciate it even more. Let me just say once again to the folks who are on the conference call that if you want to ask a question, email it to info@allhealth.org, and we'll work it in. Yes, go right ahead.
Hi, I'm Mary Agnes Carey with Kaiser Health News. Talking about the regulatory process, some groups make their comments known, the comments they're giving to the Department of Health and Human Services that's writing the regulations. How do you find the comments from the groups that don't necessarily make them public, aren't giving them to you? How much time are you spending reading these comments, and how do you track those and follow those through the regulatory process to see how they shape the regulations? I mean, we've only had a couple regs so far, but sort of how are you managing that with your workflow?
It's a good question. Let me just clarify. You're talking about the agency having issued draft regulations or final interim final regulations. Anybody want to take crack at that? Go ahead.
I can tell you I'm not doing as much as I should. I mean, I have reached out to organizations to try to get, you know, to keep track of it, but I don't know that I have a good suggestion for getting them other than going to the organizations directly. Sorry.
Anybody else want to take a crack? Bill? Bailiffs?
I know there. I don't have the website on me, but there is a federal website. Like there, we've been doing some stuff with the web portal contract that's going to come out, and there's a federal contracting website, and sort of every federal contract that goes out is on this website, and we'll make sure we get this to the Alliance so they can print it. But on this website, it usually lists sort of has an interested parties section to it, so sort of like they won't all have to bid, but interested parties who want to get information about these federal contracts, that, you know, some of these contracts might be related to things in the reform, and I think that's one area that's new to me that I just discovered.
Yeah, I have to say this is, you know, the whole regulatory process is not a very radio-friendly story. I've been agitating to do more with it because it's obviously really important to, you know, to how this comes out. There's an enormous amount in this law that is to be decided later, and later means in the regulatory process. And obviously, as you point out, finding out what the agency decides isn't necessarily dependent on the comments, but it would be interesting to track. It's more interesting to track back later, I think, what the agency decides and see who urged them to decide that. That's not necessarily going to be a quid pro quo. They're going to decide what they decide probably regardless of the comments. And as you know, for a lot of these, you know, big regs, there's going to be 30,000-40,000 comments. I don't think there's anybody that's going to be able to read all the comments, but certainly the major players are pretty eager to. I'm doing a story right now. I won't say what it is, but already just in making calls, it's like, oh, did you see our comments up on our website? And I said, no, I didn't. And said, oh, I'll send them to you. So it tends to be not that hard. You know, if they're making comments to a federal agency, they're usually pretty happy to give them to you.
The other thing I would add on the regs, I think in this case, can be pretty exciting. I mean, because there's a lot of sway. How much of an impact a lot of the law will have will depend on the regulations. I mean, I wrote a story with Mary Agnes Carey a couple weeks ago on the grandfathering clause, and we're still waiting on the regulations to come out on, well, what is a grandfather, and how they define what's going to be grandfathered and what's not is going to have huge ramifications.
Thank you, Phil. Other questions? Yes, sir. On my right, microphone is coming.
Thank you. Chris Silva, American Medical News. Are you having problems sometimes digesting what is actually in the bill? I've had sources tell me that they will pull in a team of lawyers sometimes before they could actually understand, you know, what the heck some of it means. So, I mean, do you have to read over it, reread it again several times, or do you have perhaps a staff or folks helping you out just to kind of get what exactly it's saying?
Let me just say that I've been in sessions where the committee staff who presumably wrote it said in response to a question like that, gee, I don't know, or yes and no, respectively. So it's a very good question. Julie, Robin?
Just after the bill passed, I was doing a Q&A where we had listeners, send in questions, about what it would do. And I can't remember what the question was, but I wasn't quite sure of the answer, so I sent the question to one of the staffers, one of the Senate. Actually, I sent it to the Senate and to the House staffer about, you know, what would happen to this person. I got four different answers.
From two people.
No, four different answers from four different people. So
I would think that there's two issues here. No, I don't think any of us have a staff figuring out for us. But some of the law firms do have some webcasts that are open to media and use. They're time-consuming to sit through a webcast, but some of them do help. I think one reason it is more ambiguous than some laws we've dealt with. Part of it's scope. It's enormous. But the other thing is, remember this. You know, it's the Senate bill was written to get 60 votes in the Senate in December of 2009. Nobody thought that was actually going to be the legislation. It was like a really good draft, and it ended up being the law. So, you know, with some modifications, so people thought it was going to go through more iterations. So when you try to go out and do reporting, because I've actually just written a piece about states, I mean, an awful lot of it is, you know, to be determined. So we really don't know. I have found one pretty good detailed summary, and it doesn't answer all your questions, but it's more it's the most detailed, accessible one I can think of is the CRS, Congressional Research Service, and that's online. It's about 50 pages or so.
The other thing that I know from years and years of doing this is that reading anything that's written, particularly into Title 18, which is Medicare, you almost have to pick up the code, the federal code, and lay it side by side. That's pretty much the only way to read it. Reading it, I mean, it made me incredibly insane last summer when people said, I've read the bill. It's like you cannot read anything that's written into the Medicare statute on its own and have it make any sense. You have to read it as it flows back into the Medicare statute. It's like saying that you've read it, you know, it's like reading ancient Greek. It's like you cannot possibly pick it up and read it and have any idea what it means unless you actually are sitting with a copy of the code next to it.
And just to clarify, that's because what the law that gets signed says is we hereby amend Section 1816 of the code or the Social Security Act. And you got to see what that is to see what it is they're amending and how.
And if you're not reading it, if you don't know what it is that they're amending, it means something totally different.
Just one other suggestion I guess I would make is, I mean, I've sort of tried to basically cross-reference what my understanding is with various people who are interested in that particular section. So, for instance, you know, if you're talking about grandfather plans and so forth, there is a lot of people who are getting paid a lot of money in this town to try to figure out what grandfather plans actually means at this point. Now, going to them doesn't mean you have to take their word for it, but, you know, if you're getting, I've been sort of bouncing it off of lobbyists that I know and others as well as staff, with the caveat that Julie mentioned that there is often not agreement.
Let me just take a question. Thank you very much. Take a question that has come in from one of the listeners on the conference call Diego Aparicio from the Kaiser Family Foundation and El Diario La Prensa. Did I say that right? The question is, what is the timeline of health reform news from today to August 2010 to pay attention to? How about that for a short-term goal? You've already ticked off half a dozen things that could be on that list. What do you think is the most interesting, the most important? I think we have people who are writing stories. How about the high-risk pool? Talk about that for a little bit.
The high-risk pool is to start July 1st. We've got 28 states, I believe, who have expressed a desire to run their own. The rest will be done by the federal government. So that's, I guess, the next big thing that comes out. Remember, we've got this small business tax credit that's already up and running. The young adult coverage, which doesn't start until September. Not having a timeline in front of me, there's not that much else that happened between now and then. Do you have it?
Yeah, a couple other things. Obviously, the new web portal, which is sort of going to be a precursor for the exchanges, is actually supposed to start July 1st. It's going to sort of be a listing of every individual and small group health insurance plan that's sold in the United States, which sounds pretty interesting. It's going to be pretty useless the first several months because it's basically just going to be a yellow pages, and it won't list any benefits or any costs. It's just going to be a list. The real use of it will be several months down the road when it will list costs and benefits and can actually use it to shop for plans.
And it is organized. It's supposed to be organized by state, isn't that right?
Yes.
I can't remember the deadline for the return, but the grant solicitations have begun for states to step up their insurance regulation. They'll be coming back with their proposals for how they plan to do that. That may be something to watch this summer.
How about that medical malpractice grant program? When is
2011.
That?
Next year.
Well, originally the ARC was going to put out the grants in September, but I got an email the other day telling I should look at their website. It's going to be sooner. So I don't know when. I mean, I guess sooner could be sooner than September. It could be August 30th. But I've been looking at the website. And then there's the other set of programs. There's two malpractice. The one was done by before the bill passed. It was just through Obama issued a regulation and set up that grant program. There's another $50 million in the bill for pilot projects run by the state, and I think that's 2011, but I may be wrong about the date, but there is a date in there.
We actually have a question from Linda Wishbarn from the Record, I guess that's the Bergen Record, which falls into the very timely category. Could you talk about the doc fix? and its roots and permanent solution. I'm looking for ways to balance the message that doctors are putting out to their patients about refusing to take Medicare patients any longer because of poor reimbursement. One doctor even something the owner of this newspaper to ask for coverage. Called the owner of the newspaper to ask for coverage of this issue. Another part of that bill is FMAP, that is the federal Medicaid something percentage, assistance percentage, which is the
federal matching assistance percentage.
Thank you. The federal share of Medicaid. It has big state budget implications, but it's hard to interpret or explain what's going on in Washington regarding this. Do you have any suggestions for background information?
Well, that bill is, that's what I've been doing for the last few weeks. The bill is on the Senate floor right now. It's a tax bill. It's actually called the Tax Extenders Bill. This has sort of been the bane of my existence for the last, pretty much 10 years. I just keep this, now it used to be Congress would set this aside for a year, sometimes two at a time. Now we're down to doing it every month. This, for those of you who aren't following it as painstakingly as some of us, is a 21% cut. Thank you very much. Pretty much Republicans in Congress who, before they left in 2006 when they were still in charge, decided to put off the cut to get rid of it and rather than pay for it, just make the cut bigger in the ensuing years. So it just kept getting bigger by not having it. Now it's up to 21%, which pretty much everybody agrees is a non-starter. The Democrats in the House tried to get rid of the cut and put it in the health bill, but when they realized it would cost $250 billion, that made the cost of the health bill too big, so they took it out. Then the Senate tried to put it through unpaid for by itself last November, and they couldn't get enough votes because all the Republicans voted no, and some of the Democrats voted no, too. So they can't seem to find a way to pay for it. They can't seem to find a way to not pay for it. They can't seem, to find a way to fix it at all. In the meantime, everybody, Democrats, Republicans, doctors, the AARP agrees that doctors on Medicare should not be asked to take a 21% pay cut. This is not what we usually talk about in Medicare, a reduction in the increase. This is a cut. This is a 21% cut. And so I think quite reasonably one would expect doctors to probably at least stop taking new Medicare patients, if not stop treating the Medicare patients they have. I mean, this is the real deal. They've been trying to get this through, as I say, a month at a time. Every time we're in this huge game of chicken, the last delay expired on June 1st. What Medicare can do is what they're doing now, which is hold payments for about 10 days and not pay them in hopes that Congress will fix this before, the 10th of the month, which would be today, although I think it's business day, so they may have another day or two. Meanwhile, the Senate is rather slowly pushing its way through this bill, which, as the caller points out, also has some money to help states with their Medicaid costs, and it did, in its last couple of iterations, extend money for subsidies for COBRA, for people who have been laid off to continue to pay for their health insurance, although that hasn't made it into this current iteration again because they're having trouble figuring out ways to pay for it. This is getting to be, sort of like the bad penny that keeps coming back. They just, on the one hand, they don't want to find ways to pay for it. On the other hand, they want to keep doing it, and it keeps going around and around and around. And as I say now, the Senate seems to be in no hurry to get this done, although, as I mentioned, this 21% cut is in the process of taking effect. Now, I've had recently a couple of reporters suggesting that this is, doctors crying about not getting their raises, but I think this is a fairly serious thing if you're a doctor or if you're a Medicare patient.
I think the story at the local level on this is finally, what are doctors doing in reaction to this? I mean, doctors in the AMA have said for years, well, there's going to be more and more people leaving Medicare. But the data has shown, I think, MedPAC year after year, that the percentage of doctors in Medicare has remained pretty steady, right?
They've never taken a 21% cut.
Right. But it hasn't gone into effect either. They've been threatened with it. So the balance of reporters, I think, we face is that on the one hand, they're faced with this threat, and that they threaten to leave Medicare, yet the data so far shows that they're not. But I think there's a lot of stories to be done in communities about what are doctors doing to raise to raise revenue? What are they doing on the side? You know, if they're so threatened with this, then are they running to join integrated groups? Are they do they want to be owned by their local hospital? And typically not. And I think there's a lot of good stories to be written out there about how are doctors, because they're businessmen and women, and how are they reacting? What are they doing facing this?
Joanne, can
I? Phil just made a few of the points I would have made, but I think you can look at a few things. I mean, we haven't seen. We've heard doctors saying we're not going to take Medicare patients anymore for, you know, 10 years now, but we have never seen a 21% in supposed. I mean, I don't think any of us think that there will actually be a 21% decrease. But I agree with Julie, this is a different magnitude. But you also, I think that there are a couple of things you can do story-wise. I think, you know, look at some of the data in your community and the Dartmouth data elsewhere. Some doctors, not all, some doctors, they get paid less per visit. They just do more visits. You know, there are places that see their hypertension patients every couple of weeks, and there are other places that will see them once a year. So what is your community doing, and is it changing? If you can find that out, it's, I mean, there's not up-to-date data lists for every, you know, practice in town. You know, I anecdotally, you'll find stories like that, though. The other thing is, you know, there's this really big disconnect, because here we are having this huge fight about payment and fee-for-service medicine for Medicare at the same time that we've just had this legislation that's supposed to pave the way toward new payment systems and new incentives. So, you know, it's, you know, one of the many cognitive disconnects, I think, in the healthcare system. But I think that to talk about what Phil was doing about looking at doctors as businessmen, there's also a lot of stories in the way younger doctors expect to practice the way versus the, you know, the 50-year-old practices of 2 and 3 doctors, the onesies and Tuesdays, they call them. There's some evidence that's already come out. And you can talk to local doctors, what's your nearest medical school? Because I think talking to young doctors, what they don't know about the healthcare system is sometimes, I mean, I'm not supposed to know more than they do, but what they think that they can give their patients or how they think the world works is actually sort of an astonishing story sometimes.
Before we leave this question, can I go back to the other half, which was the federal matching percentage of the Medicaid money? Is that, how critical is that, say, relative to the doc fix?
If you're a state and you've already put that money in your budget and your legislature has gone home, which is something like 38 out of 50, it's a lot of money. I mean, it's huge. So I personally think that something will happen in Congress because red states and blue have already put that in their budget.
What actually happened is that the House passed the bill without the Medicaid money in it, but the bill that's on the Senate floor has put the money back. So.
You know, one thing.
No.
One thing just to broadly to think about in the context of this FMAP debate is sort of I don't know that has sunk in yet necessarily that the big shiny new healthcare system that sort of is envisioned is like this superhighway, which begins in 2014, but we're going on this like rutted dirt road that is basically collapsing between now and 2014, and states are struggling. They need the FMAP money just to maintain their current Medicaid coverage. I mean, there's every indication that employers are going to continue to sort of slice away at the benefits that they provide. Premiums are going to rise. So something to think about is, to get back to what Phil was talking about earlier, that in some sense the stories are the same as they've always been. Those sorts of problems that everybody has had with the healthcare system aren't probably going to get addressed by an extra $5 billion for a high-risk pool between now and 2014. So.
Okay. Yes. Right over here, if we can get a microphone.
I'm Kim Song with the Seattle Times. What do you think are the major regulatory decisions, particularly at the federal level, that would really ultimately determine what this health reform bill accomplishes?
Do we have enough time to get an answer to that question? Joanne Kennan, you're going to take a crack at that?
Well, I think there are probably 1,000, but, you know, we don't know what the exchanges are going to look like. I mean, we know that there's going to be some kind of federal parameters, and we know that states are going to have leeway on how they meet those parameters, but we really don't know what the federal, I mean, you know, we know more or less what Medicaid looks like, right? I mean, you know, they're going to get money. They're going to get a lot of money for the expansion. They're not going to get more money for the current. There's two populations of Medicaid. They're the people who are currently eligible. Only, was it roughly 60%? Real round numbers, I may not have this exactly right, but roughly 60% of the eligible people in the current system are in Medicaid. Don't quote me on that exact number without looking it up, but I'm in the ballpark. And then there's this whole new world of newly eligible Medicaid people up to 133% of poverty, including childless adults, and that's a huge change. The federal government is going to pay the bulk of this FMAP thing we've been talking about, it's different for this new population. The federal government is going to pay about 95% of that from 2014 to 2019. So that part, you know, we know what's broken in Medicaid. Lots of things are broken in Medicaid. We know what it looks like. We really don't know what, I mean, think of how a state like Oregon is going to build an exchange versus a state like Utah. I mean, they're going to look very different. So I don't even think, you know, HHS really knows what. So if I were to ask, like, what's my big regulation question, it's what's the ceiling? What do the states have to do for the exchange?
And I'd add to that on the exchanges, you know, what about outside the exchanges? You know, what's going to be the market outside? And then that could, you know, if the market outside remains relatively big, you could basically just get all the sickest people inside the exchange and the healthy people be outside the
exchange.
Except
the subsidies are all in the exchange. That's
that would have to, the other effect I would look at is that I'm waiting on is this grant, how to define a grandfather plan, and are they going to define that if you make a simple change to a health plan, if you change co-payments or change the deductibles or change the premium, does that end your grandfather status, or does it have to be something, you know, health insurers basically say you should be able to do almost anything and keep your grandfather status. If you can keep your grandfather status, it means you don't have to follow many of the new rules that will go into effect, such as eliminating cost sharing. Because under eliminating cost sharing, you may not have to do that. So health insurers are really pushing. It's a big debate going on right now, and I think that's why the White House and the administration hasn't come out with regs, because they don't know what to do. Because it's a question of, you know, the president said in the outset of the debate was, if you like your plan, you can keep it. Well, that's great, but he's also said, well, we want to fix this broken system. And how do you balance those two things? And that's what they're struggling with.
I'm really interested in what they're going to come up with on some of these new payment systems and how they're going to define some of these things. Obviously, the big medical loss ratio fight, what's a medical you know, what's administrative versus what's medical, and that's going to bleed over into some of these new payment systems and in Medicare about the medical homes and the accountable health organizations. I mean, some of those are not technically regulatory, but in setting those up, you know, this new Center for Innovation, what they're, because I think that's going to be in the end what's going to determine whether or not this law really does work to kind of bend the cost curve and change the paradigm about how healthcare is delivered. I think those are, in the end, a whole lot more important than some of these things about which everybody's fighting and everybody's concerned for how well this works, you know, in terms of you know, making people of the current marketplace. But I'm thinking much longer term, whether this works in terms of creating a new paradigm about how healthcare is delivered and paid for.
In lowering costs.
And just a quick response to that.
Hang on just a second, Craig. Let somebody get to you with a microphone. And by the way, we have only about 10 minutes left, so I would ask folks who are asking questions and our panel to be as brief as they can in the exchanges. Yes, Craig Palmer.
I just wanted to say, look beyond the usual suspects for where you go to find the answers to that. The HHS and the ancillary agencies. Look at the IRS, for instance. They're going to do a lot of defining of how this is going to go. The tax on devices, the FSAs. There's fertile ground beyond HHS, which we presume is going to be the major arbiter.
The tanning tax.
And will have a great impact.
The Department of Labor is going to play a
very major role in a lot of this.
Labor too.
Thank you. Yes, we have someone. Do you still have a question? Yes.
Hi, Maureen Grappi with the Gannett Washington Bureau. I write for our Indiana papers, and the governor of Indiana has spoken out a lot against this. He was here this week. He's going to be here next week. He's been in the Wall Street Journal. I wondered if there are others, other governors who are speaking out as forcefully as he is against this, or if he kind of stands out there. Is he notably a notable opponent?
Well, no. Haley Barbour's been very vocal as well. A number of the red state governors have been pretty critical of this. I mean, the funny thing, I was listening to the Indiana governor talking, I think he said part of the reason for his projection that the state couldn't afford to do this was because 100% of all eligible people would sign up for Medicaid. So it's just a caution to again, sort of take what is said with a grain of salt.
Before we go over here, let me just take a couple of questions that together I think should be on other sides of the same coin. One from Felice Fryer at the Providence Journal says she'd like some suggestions on how to make these stories interesting to average readers. How do we get over the wonk echo chamber effect On the other hand, Elizabeth Slovic from the Grand Rapids Business Journal says, as a health reporter for a very small and business-focused publication, part of the problem in covering reform is finding anybody local who knows anything about it. Everyone seems to shrug their shoulders. What types of folks are the best local state sources, and how about a Go Blue shout to Julie Rotner for that purpose? Either one of those stimulate an answer?
The nice, and hi to Liz, who's a college classmate of mine. The nice thing about healthcare is that everybody uses it, so it's easy to find, you know, local people, and that's not to say that you can't find local people who use healthcare and then find national experts to comment. That's obviously an easy way to do your story. Find local small business people, you know, what are they doing, and then you can get your experts from out of town. You don't necessarily need to find your experts in town, and you're probably not going to, as, you know, we point out that even the experts here, even the people who wrote the bill, don't necessarily agree on how it's working. So you can certainly find your local people who are impacted by it, because everybody's impacted by it, and then go outside to find the people who can comment on it.
And how do you find the people who don't reinforce that wonk echo chamber that the other reporter was asking about? Where do you find people who talk English?
Well, sometimes that's a reporter's job. You know, I think, we got to know how to speak these other health reform languages, but then turn it into languages that readers can do. So, you know, I guess sometimes it's hard to look for a good quote, and I've been in this business 20 years, and if anybody can help me get good quotes, I'm happy to have the advice. But I think it's understanding the language and reaching out and talking to, you know, bring the story down to its localist level, and that would be my sense to the local reporters, because I've been there, and, you know, talking to the hospital CEOs, talking to doctors, you're not asking them what's in the bill, and I wouldn't ask them how would you be affected. I would ask them today, what are you doing to control costs? If I was meeting with a hospital CEO, Your budget, you're going to get less money for Medicare, and they know that. That's pretty simple. What are they doing to control their costs? And talking to health insurers, what are they going to do? They're going to have less money to do it, and how are they reacting to that?
Yes.
I think Phil's absolutely right. The people who are actually practicing, the people who are running hospitals, running medical clinics, running insurance companies, they don't tend to talk as much in jargon, at least in my experience, because they're actually down there, they figuring what nuts and bolts are. It's sort of people in Washington or, you know, the quote-unquote usual suspect experts. We tend to sort of get lost in that big policy sort of wonky talk.
Can I just throw in that one of the answers to that question that Phil Galewitz's comments evoked for me, based on a conference that I've been going to the last couple of days, you might want to talk to the big employers in the area, because they're the ones who are telling the insurance companies what they're going to be allowed to do to hold down costs.
And the big employer is often your local school district. It's in most towns, it's the schools, and it's your city, and it's city hall, and it's government in the large majority of towns in America.
And the hospital.
And the hospital, and the hospital itself, ironically. Is that it?
Yes, over here.
Hi, I'm Jeff Young from Bloomberg Government. We all tried to do our best to exhaustively cover the contents of this legislation as it went through Congress, but speaking for myself, after the president signed it, I kept running into things and going, wait, what's in there? And some specific fairly interesting things, and I won't go through and list them now, partly because it's sort of embarrassing. But that said, I'm wondering if you guys have examples of stuff that you had a wait, what moment sometime, you know, in March, April, May, or maybe earlier today.
Or June or July.
I think we're going to be having them all right up through 2014. I mean, you can, every time you look at the bill, you do. I mean, Kaiser Health did one a story a few months ago about, like, you know, midwives that I didn't know about. And I guess the nursing mothers I actually knew about. So I don't know what that says about how much time I spent reading this stuff. You know, like the menu label thing, which Julie mentioned, it's been really covered. And, you know, talk to anybody. They don't know what's in there. So that's...
Yeah.
I mean, I think we're all still being surprised when we read.
I still have a few, but they're on my story list that I don't really want to share with a lot of other reporters right now.
I'm going down one of the many timetables that have come across my desk, and one of the ones I starred has a date of July of this year, and it is described as the interim final rule, the deadline for it, for designating medically underserved areas and health professional shortage areas through negotiated rulemaking. Now, this is a big deal for distributing the money that pays the salaries of the National Health Service Corps people and the debt forgiveness allocations for med students to serve in these areas. So there's one to pay attention to.
And the debt forgiveness just got increased in this bill by, I believe, to $50,000 a year, too.
I mean, one piece of advice I do, and I'm a little ashamed for Kaiser again, but that, you know, they have this great summary, and it's pretty, you know, it's like 14-page summary, and it's pretty small type, and it's got a lot of stuff in there. But even when you go into some of these things where it lists some different different benefits and new programs, and then what you do is you go into the bill and you hit Control F, and then you find the details in the bill that even get into extraordinary more details. And I just think there's a whole avenue of so many stories to do there. So that's what I would do. I'd read the summaries, a lot of details there, and then do that and try to find them.
We have time for just one or two more questions. Right behind you, Jill.
I have a really quick, stupid question. I'm Jill Wexler. I write for Trade Press for pharmaceutical and insurance industry. Is there consensus on the name of this bill?
It's not a bill.
It's a law.
I have noticed that all the HHS press releases are now just calling it the Affordable
Care
Act. And everything else before that, in fact, I'm looking at Health Affairs, the Patient Protection Affordable Care Act. I saw some reg recently that explained that it's combining two bills or something into the Affordable Care Act. Well, maybe somebody can say, is there a consensus among journalists who try and get things accurate?
I had an argument online. I can't remember whether it was on the AHCJ listserv or if there was a big fight about, you know, whether it's PPAC, just about the acronym, whether it's ACA or PPACA. And, of course, it did. I mean, the reason that it did combine, and the reason there was no printed copy of the final law for so long is because it did combine. Remember, it combined the Senate version of the bill with the reconciliation bill. So that took a while, and someone quietly told me that there were actually mistakes, and it was sort of hard to put them together, which happens when you're doing that kind of legislating. But no, I have not actually, and I've seen official, both White House and HHS stuff that has referred to it both ways. And I know, it's a fascinating, you know, anthropological thing to me. I have not seen any consensus, even from official sources, about which it is.
This reminds me of just one caution that I would urge, too. If you are going through the bill and you do find a section that you're interested in and you want to go read it, make sure you check the end, too, because the manager's amendment that Senator Reid did at the end of last year is attached right now at the end of the bill. I made the mistake of going to check legislative language on something I was writing. I saw it in the bill and forgot to go check. Oh, you know, on page 900 it says, way back when on page 200, actually we are going to do this, so be careful.
That's right. Remember, so it's really three things. It's the Senate bill as amended by the reconciliation bill as amended by the manager's amendment.
Got that?
So bottom line, let's just call it the health law.
Well, I think we have, one last question we have from Barbara Fader Ostro at the California Endowment Health Journalism Fellowships. What issues are you covering relative to electronic health records? There is a ton of money to develop them, and hospitals are now wrestling with meaningful use definitions. And what are some of the uncovered stories in this area? $19 or $25 billion worth.
I guarantee it is not a radio friendly. That's the ultimate not radio friendly story.
But that's a story that's not really this health law. That's a story. Well, it's been a story for years and years.
Yeah.
But that's the stimulus. That's the money from the stimulus that was passed 14 months ago, and the big money of that comes out next year. And that's a huge story. I mean, because the billion, I think it's $20 billion that's going to help doctors finally go online, because as if they had to discover it in 2011. But the money from that actually flows out to doctors. It's supposed to flow out next year. The money's been starting to flow out this year to what they call these regional RIOs, I think I call it. But there's some regional organizations that have solely got some of the money. So I think, I think it's a huge story, and I think it becomes a huge story next year when the billions start flowing into doctors' offices and how they decide which doctors and which hospitals are eligible for that money. And then which companies get chosen to put the standards together and which companies can put out the these new electronic systems.
And that, I think, is going to be the last word, Phil Galewitz. Thanks to Phil and Julie and Joanne, Julie Rodner and Joanne Kennan, Noam Levy. Thanks also to the Robert Johnson Foundation and the Association of Healthcare Journalists. Thanks to you both in the room and on the line who kept it lively and made us realize how many more stories there are to tell. Thank you for coming, and we'll see you next time.